Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 26th, Wednesday, reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Panel seeks independence. Members want $1 million from the state to hire attorney investigator, by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. Snowmaking, ski resorts scrutinize systems in drought, by Thomas Peipert, the Associated Press. And Winter Olympics, China appears less worried about global criticism, by Stephen Wade, the Associated Press. Colorado Commission on Judicial Discipline, panel seeks independence. Members want $1 million from state to hire attorney investigator, by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. The Colorado Commission on Judicial Discipline's attempt last summer to hire a law firm to investigate allegations of widespread misconduct by judges stalled because the state Supreme Court did not fund the endeavor, commission members told legislators during a hearing Tuesday. The commission is now seeking independent funding so that it can do its work without the influence of judges and justices it is tasked with overseeing, Commission Chair Elizabeth Espinoza Krupa told lawmakers. To make sure that the public and citizens of Colorado are assured the integrity of the commission and the independence of the commission, we cannot have funding controlled by judicial leadership, she said. The Commission on Judicial Discipline is responsible for disciplining the state's judges. The group consists of a volunteer board, a paid executive director, and a part-time administrative assistant. The commission has traditionally relied on either the state's Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel or the Attorney General's Office to conduct investigations when needed, but the commission is now asking for its state funding to be increased to about $1 million so that it can hire a full-time staff attorney and investigator to allow the commission to conduct its own investigations without relying on outside help. District Judge David Prince, vice chair of the commission, said last summer's probe by a special counsel stalled in part because judicial leadership was attempting to influence the scope of the investigation. We've been in disagreement with them now for about 4 months, and part of that disagreement has been judicial leadership asserting they have the authority to direct what would be the proper scope of our retention of counsel, he said, adding later that the funding is independent in the written rules but is not operating that way. Colorado Supreme Court Justice Brian Boatwright told lawmakers in a separate presentation Tuesday that he welcomed the commission's independence. We completely support that, he said. We absolutely value the independence of the Judicial Discipline Commission. Their work is essential to having confidence with regard to the branch. He added, under its fiscal rules, that the state Supreme Court must approve any expenditures of more than $5,000 out of attorney registration fees, which currently fund the commission. That clearly can't work under the current circumstances, Boatwright said. We should not be looking at the expenditures of the Judicial Discipline Commission. The commission's investigation is one of several that were launched after the Denver Post last year reported on allegations of judicial misconduct and a cover-up at the highest levels of the state's court system. Boatwright said the two law firms hired by the state to conduct investigations have been given unfettered access to documents and records that are not publicly available as they conduct their 5- and 6-month queries. Krupa said the Commission on Judicial Discipline has not been granted such access. Snowmaking. Ski resorts scrutinize systems in drought, by Thomas Peipert, the Associated Press. The sight can be jarring during extreme drought, snowmaking guns lined up on a mountainside, blasting precious crystal flakes on a ski run while the rest of the land goes thirsty. Snowpack in the U.S. West has decreased by about 20% in the last century, making human-made snow more vital each year to opening ski resorts and fueling ski town economies as they head into uncertain future. As the effects of drought and climate change increasingly hit home, the ski industry has invested millions of dollars in more efficient snowmaking systems amid questions about whether the practice is a wise use of energy and water. There are impacts. They are regrettable. We'd rather not have to make snow, said Auden Schindler, Senior Vice President of Sustainability at Aspen Skiing Company in Colorado. But our original economy and economies of all ski towns depend on your ski resort operating. So this is a necessary evil. Snowmaking has been around since at least the 1950s, but the practice became more widespread in the West after a severe drought in the late 1970s, according to the Colorado-based National Ski Areas Association. About 87% of the 337 U.S. Alpine resorts the trade group represents have snowmaking capabilities. Many resorts draw water from nearby streams or reservoirs and typically use compressed air and electricity to blow snow into piles on the slopes when it's cold. Those piles are then spread into a base layer that allows resorts to open in the early winter and to stay open through the spring. An analysis of most of the ski resorts in Colorado found snowmaking diverts about 1.5 billion gallons of water per year in the state, said Kevin Ryan, state engineer and director of Colorado Division of Water Resources. That's enough to fill about 2,200 Olympic-sized swimming pools. It sounds like a lot, but Ryan said snowmaking accounts for less than 0.1% of the water that is diverted in the state, with agriculture drawing about 85%. Moreover, about 80% of the water used in snowmaking returns to the watershed when the snow melts in the spring. Snowmaking is recognized by the courts as a beneficial use in Colorado, said Ryan, whose agency regulates the process. It's part of our tourism. It's part of what we do in Colorado. But Patrick Belmont, a professor and head of the Department of Watershed Sciences at Utah State University, said it's important to note that a lot of energy is used during snowmaking and a lot of water is lost through evaporation and sublimation. It's not insignificant, especially in a place where we don't have a whole lot of water to begin with. Every drop of water matters, he said. Belmont, an avid skier who recently published a wide-ranging study on snowmaking and climate change, also is concerned that human-made snow, which is denser and melts later than the real thing, can affect stream flows. There are a lot of fish that take their cues for things like when to spawn or when to do different things in their life based upon how the flows are going up or down. So we're changing those types of natural cues for some of those organisms, he said. Ski resorts have made huge strides in becoming more efficient and environmentally friendly, said Schindler of the Aspen Skiing Company, but he also recalled a time when they often didn't pay much attention to weather forecasts, only to see the fruits of their labor melt in the warm afternoon sun. One way the industry has gotten smarter is they said, look, we're not going to make snow if it's not cold, and there's not a forecast for it to stay cold, he said. That sounds dumb and analog, but the industry is historically very analog. Many resorts also have invested heavily in recent years to upgrade their snowbanking operations. Some have dug storage ponds to collect water in the spring when it's abundant, while a few are looking into the use of reclaimed wastewater. Colorado-based Vail Resorts, which owns 37 ski resorts in the U.S., Canada, and Australia, announced during an earnings call in December a $3.6 million investment in its sustainability efforts this year, including making its snowmaking operations more energy efficient. Over the past few years, the company has upgraded more than 400 snow guns across its resorts to blast more snow with less energy in less time. Meanwhile, Breckenridge, which is owned by Vail Resorts and is one of the country's largest and most popular ski areas, is getting 110 efficient snow guns. If I can make all the snow we need in a third of the time, that's a huge energy savings. It's a huge labor savings, said Kate Schifani, snowmaking manager at Colorado's Vail Mountain Resort. Vail's modern snow guns can regulate water output and automatically shut down when the weather gets too warm, a major upgrade from older technology that required workers to monitor the temperature and manually turn off the system. Besides using water more efficiently, ski areas are tapping more renewable energy to power snow guns, which account for about 20% of the typical resort's energy usage. The National Ski Areas Association decade-old Climate Challenge program encourages resorts to inventory and reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, as well as advocate for legislation to combat climate change. Since its inception, the voluntary program has cut emissions by about 129,300 tons, according to the group. Participating resorts also have purchased renewable energy that accounts for an additional reduction of about 242,500 tons of greenhouse gas emissions. Those are the tiny amounts compared. Those are tiny amounts compared to the United States' estimated 6 billion tons of greenhouse gases produced in 2021, according to the independent Rhodium Group. But advocates say it's a start. We can do what we can in our own operations, but there's going to be a future in outdoor recreation and future for humanity. Just in general, we're going to need every kind of solution we can find, said Adrian Saya Isaac, an NSAA spokeswoman. We've got to effect change now. Schindler, who warns that the ski industry is not on track to be viable beyond 2050, agrees. The industry has historically responded to climate change by saying, we're going to clean our operations, we're going to do good snowmaking, we're going to cut our carbon footprint, he said. That's awesome and noble and moral and good business, but it's not a solution to a global problem. Winter Olympics. China appears less worried about global criticism, by Stephen Wade, the Associated Press. When Beijing was awarded the 2008 Summer Olympics, the International Olympic Committee predicted the Games could improve human rights, and Chinese politicians hinted at the same. Such talk is all but absent this time, as the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics open in just more than a week. The Games are a reminder of both China's rise and its disregard for civil liberties, which has prompted a diplomatic boycott led by the U.S. Rights groups have documented forced labor, mass detentions, and torture, and the U.S. has called China's internment of at least 1 million Uyghurs genocide. China has come under criticism over the near disappearance from public view of tennis star Ping Xiao after she accused a former senior member of the ruling Communist Party of sexually assaulting her. But with more political, economic, and military clout than it had 13,000 years ago, China appears to be worrying less about global scrutiny this time. And COVID-19 pandemic has given it even more control over the Olympics, particularly with the isolation of visiting journalists separated in a bubble from Chinese population. There's nothing to prove at this point. 2008 was a coming out party, and all this one does is confirm what we've known for the last decade. Amanda Schumann, a China researcher at the University of Freiburg, wrote in an email to the Associated Press. If anything, there's a lot less pressure than 2008, she said. The Chinese government knows full well that its global economic upper hand allows it to do whatever it wishes. The IOC had few options when it awarded China the Games for the second time. Six possible European candidates, led by Norway and Sweden, bowed out for political or cost reasons. Voters in two other countries, Switzerland and Germany, voted no in referendums. IOC members eventually picked Beijing, an authoritarian state that doesn't need voter approval to proceed, over Almaty, Kazakhstan, in a close vote, 44-40. The IOC has allowed China to avoid human rights oversight, beginning with the 2024 Paris Olympics. Host cities must adhere to the UN guiding principles on business and human rights. But China is not subject to those rules when it was picked in 2015. When China hosts the Olympics again, it is no longer the China back in 2008. Dissident Chinese artist Ali Weiwei said in an email to the Associated Press. AI helped design the famous Bird's Nest Stadium that was used in the 2008 games, hoping it would signify a new openness, and then regretted doing so, calling it in the Olympics China's fake smile. AI was jailed in 2011 in China on unspecified charges and now lives in exile in Portugal. The Bird's Nest will again host the opening ceremony on February 4th. China today has deviated further away from democracy, freedom of press, and human rights, and the reality has become even harsher, AI said. China's tone has toughened since the last time it hosted the games. In 2008, Beijing put some curbs on broadcasting from Tiananmen Square, but allowed it, agreed to protest zones, though they were never used, with access repeatedly denied and dropped some reporting restrictions more than a year ahead of the games. It also unblocked its censored internet for journalists. In 2022, there is less accommodation. The pandemic will limit journalists to a tightly sealed bubble, though there will be internet access. Chinese organizers have warned foreign athletes that any statement that goes against Chinese law could be punished. And a smartphone app widely used by athletes and reporters has glaring security vulnerabilities, according to an internet watchdog. Some national Olympic committees have advised teams and staff not to take personal phones or laptops to Beijing. The IOC, which generates billions from sponsorships and broadcast rights, seldom pushes back in public against Chinese organizers who are in reality the Chinese government. Some of the changes that affect 2022 began a month after the 2008 Olympics ended, when the global finance crisis hit. China fared better than most countries, which increased its confidence. China has since seen the rise of Xi Jinping, who headed the 2008 Olympics and was named General Secretary of the Communist Party in 2012. Although Xi was in charge of the 2008 Olympic Games, the Winter Games is truly Xi's games, said Zhu Kua, who teaches history at the University of Hong Kong. He is the author of Olympic Dreams, China and Sports, 1895 to 2008. Mary Gallagher, director of the Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan, said the state of U.S. democracy and its poor pandemic response have further emboldened China. Right now, the multiple U.S. failures create momentum for renewed nationalism and confidence in China, Gallagher said by email. This is made all the more effective by Communist Party's strict control over information, which can rain positive energy down on what's happening in China, while only publicizing negative accounts of other countries, especially the U.S. China complained in 2008 that human rights protests around Tibet politicized the Olympics. The Olympic torch relay taken on a world tour faced violent protests in London and elsewhere. The IOC has not tried such a relay since. China has called the allegations of human rights abuses the lie of the century, says mixing sports and politics goes against the Olympics charter. IOC President Thomas Bach said likewise used the principle as a shield against critics. But others see hypocrisy on China's part. Sports and politics do mix, Laura Luhrmann, a China specialist at Wright State University, said in an email. Politics is about the distribution and use of limited resources, most notably power and decision-making, but also finances as well. Sports is all about power and money, even if framed as glorifying athletic achievement. Victor Cha, who served in the White House under President George W. Bush and is the author of Beyond the Final Score, The Politics of Sports in Asia, said China's moaning about others politicizing sports is the pot calling the kettle black. There is no country that has ignored the Olympic Charter's mandate to keep politics out of sports more than China, Cha, who teaches at Georgetown University, wrote in an essay last week for the Center for strategic and international studies. Much as the world would like the Olympics to be devoid of politics, as George Orwell once wrote, sport is war minus the shooting. Anger over mask policy temporarily shuts museum. The Children's Museum of Denver at Marseco campus is temporarily shutting down after some visitors who oppose the facility's mask policy directed their anger at museum staff. The museum at 2121 Children's Museum Drive will close its doors to the public from Wednesday through February 4th, according to a news release. The museum carefully follows public health guidelines, including mask wearing, the release said. We know the stress of the last 2 years has taken a toll on everyone in our community, but regrettably, some guests who object to the museum's mask policy have been inappropriately directing their anger toward the staff. For almost 50 years, the museum has been a community of gathering, a place where families can share the moments of wonder and joy, the release said. The temporary closure announced Tuesday is a way for the museum to support our staff and bolster our policies with the hope of preventing this type of behavior in the future. The museum said it appreciates and values guests who respect the mask policy. We are sorry that the unacceptable behavior of others means you cannot enjoy the museum at this time, the release said. All reservations for the closure period have been canceled. Premature and unwarranted. DAs criticize Polis' reduction of sentence for I-70 trucker, by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. Governor Jared Polis' decision to abruptly reduce the 110-year prison sentence for the truck driver who killed four people in a fiery 2019 crash is impacting other ongoing court cases. A bipartisan pair of Colorado district attorneys told the governor in a five-page letter that was highly criticized of the commutation. Boulder County District Attorney Michael Dougherty, a Democrat, and Mesa County District Attorney Dan Rubenstein, a Republican, called the commutation unprecedented, premature, and unwarranted in a January 20th letter to Polis obtained by the Denver Post on Tuesday through an open records request. The prosecutor said the governor's decision to reduce Rogel Aguila Medeiros' 110-year sentence to 10 years while the trucker's case was still pending in the courts undercut the community's trust in the justice system and has impacted plea bargaining negotiations in some cases. Your decision is having a substantial ripple effect, the district attorneys wrote. In a recent Boulder County case, they said prosecutors extended a plea offer of 8 years in prison to a person who sexually assaulted a girl. The defense attorney in that case argued the sentence was excessive in light of Aguila Medeiros' reduced prison term, the letter said. Sentences should be influenced by the facts and circumstances, not by petitions, online surveys, or tweets, the letter said. The two district attorneys sent the letter to Polis the day before the governor was scheduled to meet with the board of Colorado District Attorney's Council. The letter was intended to allow Polis to prepare to address their concerns, Dougherty said. The governor wanted to clear the air and acknowledge that his action was unprecedented, Dougherty said of the meeting. D.A. Rubenstein and I are optimistic that our concerns were understood and that what happened in that case was an exception. Connor Cahill, a spokesman for Polis, called Aguila Medeiros' 110-year prison sentence bizarre and said Polis acted quickly because these are clearly an urgency to remedy this sentence and restore confidence in the uniformity and fairness of our criminal justice system. Both Dougherty and Rubenstein said in the letter that the 110-year prison sentence was excessive, but argued that Polis should have waited for a judge to reduce his sentence, a process that was underway before acting. Aguila Medeiros' mandatory minimum sentence drew widespread outrage after it was imposed in December, with more than 5 million people signing an online petition that asked it be reduced. Polis' decision to commute the sentence days before the judge overseeing Aguila Medeiros' case was scheduled to consider reducing the prison term, drew rebukes from the judge and from family members of people who died in the April 25th, 2019 crash on Interstate 70 in Lakewood. Anti-Semitic flyers distributed in Denver, Arvada, by Kieran Nicholson, the Denver Post. Anti-Semitic flyers placed in plastic baggies containing rice were distributed over the weekend in parts of Denver and Arvada, and the incidents are under police investigation. The flyers, according to the Anti-Defamation League, Mountain States Region, contained various anti-Semitic messages, including every single aspect of the COVID agenda is Jewish. The flyers were left on driveways in Arvada overnight Saturday and around West 72nd Avenue and Oak Street and northwest of the intersection, said Detective Dave Snelling, a police spokesman. Arvada police received more than two dozen reports about the flyers, which have been collected as evidence. We are investigating, Snelling said. It is a concern to the community and a concern to us. On Sunday, Denver police received reports of flyers containing anti-Semitic language from residents of the Country Club neighborhood. These flyers were being investigated by DPD's bias-motivated crime unit, police said in a statement. White supremacist and anti-vaccine propaganda was also distributed locally with the anti-Semitic messages, according to the ADL. It is especially despicable and disgusting that a group of anti-Semites would choose to distribute hateful anti-Semitic propaganda just 1 week after the hostage situation at the synagogue in Colleyville, Texas, said ADL Mountain States Regional Director Scott Levin in a written statement. It is important to expose this type of hateful activity and to shine a light on the increase in anti-Semitism in Colorado and across the country. Similar anti-Semitic propaganda was distributed over the weekend in California, Florida, Maryland, and Texas, according to the ADL. The ADL has tracked a significant increase in white supremacist propaganda efforts in Colorado and the U.S., the organization said in a news release. ADL's Center on Extremism tracked a near doubling of white supremacist propaganda distributions in 2020, with a total of 5,125 cases reported nationwide. A total of 117 white supremacist propaganda incidents have been reported in Colorado in 2020 and 2021. There were 60 anti-Semitic incidents reported in Colorado to the ADL in 2020, making it the second highest number of reports in the last 10 years. People can report biased activities to the ADL at www.adl.org/report-incident. Anyone with information on weekend flyers is asked to call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Faye E. Fuchser, July 31st, 1926 to January 18th, 2022. Faye E. Fuchser of Thornton, Colorado, passed away on January 18th, 2022. Memorial services to be held later at a later date in the spring. Check crownhillfuneral.com for details. Ida Garneck, 98, a Holocaust survivor, passed away January 25th. 2022, wife of the late Morris Garneck, mother of Tilly, husband Howard Rollin, Sam Garneck, and Joe Garneck. Service Friday, 1 p.m. HEA, live stream on HEA's YouTube channel. Interment Mount Nebo Memorial Park, live stream on Feldman Mortuary's YouTube channel. Contributions to JFS, Denver Hospice, or HEA. Larry T. Glover, March 23, 1941 to January 7, 2022. Larry Theron Glover of Lakewood, Colorado, passed away on January 17, 2022. He was born March 23, 1941. A celebration of life will be held on July 21, 2022. Details at crownhillfuneral.com. Henry E. Guerrero, Sr. Henry E. Guerrero, Sr. passed away January 13, 2022. Friday, January 28th, Rosary at 10:30 a.m., Mass at 11 a.m., Immaculate Heart of Mary, 11385 Grant Street, Grant Drive, burial, 12:30 p.m., Olinger's Highland Cemetery, North Glen, Colorado. Ben J. Hogan, July 6, 1930 to January 3, 2022. Ben, 91, of Denver, originally from McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania, entered eternal life on January 3, 2022. He is survived by his children, Tim, wife Cindy, Katie, husband Bruce Countryman, Colleen, husband Raj Goffredi, Teresa, husband Larry Ostrom, Don, the late Ann, Ann, husband Ken Olguin, Ray, wife Anita and Sharon, husband Mike Boyle, 23 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, brothers Al, Dick, husband, wife Sandy, sister-in-law Fran Hogan, and numerous nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his wife Pat Slattery Hogan, infant son, brothers Paul, Chuck, Ed, and Joe, his sister Mary Ellen Sleen, and great-granddaughter Jaden Hogan. Recitation of the Rosary will be held at 10:30 a.m., followed by a funeral mass at 11 a.m. on Friday, January 28th at Guardian Angels Catholic Church, 1843 West 52nd Avenue, Denver, Colorado, 80221. Interment will follow at Mount Olivet Catholic Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Guardian Angels Catholic Church. Please share memories at PeranCares.com. Glenn W. Kent, M.D., of Greenwood Village, beloved husband of Charlotte, services 11 a.m. Thursday, January 27, 2022, Cherry Creek Presbyterian Church, 10150 East Bellevue Avenue, Inglewood, 80111. Full obituary and details at ellisfamilyservices.com. Wilmer Dean Will Landon, February 22, 1923 to September 26, 2021, retired landman. Contact Barbara Bennett, 303-750-8609. Robert Stevens. Robert Russell Stevens, age 93, of Denver, passed in peace on Wednesday, January 19, 2022. Please see full obituary at www.olingerhighland.com. Visitation will be 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, January 26, 2022, and the memorial service will be at 10 a.m. on Thursday, January 27, 2022 at Olinger Highland Mortuary. Michael Mike Underwood, October 26, 1952 to January 21st, 2022. Lawrence Michael Mike Underwood, beloved husband, father, and Gaga, passed away suddenly on January 21st, 2022 at age 69. Mike was born October 26, 1952 in Denver, Colorado to Robert and Janice Underwood. He graduated from George Washington High School and continued on to the University of Northern Colorado. He graduated in 1974 with a degree in business administration and a minor in finance. He married his first wife and mother to his two children, Valerie, in 1975. Mike then served in the United States Navy in Pensacola, Florida, as a naval aviator. He returned to Denver, where his first jobs were in construction with his father and selling used cars. He then tried his hand at selling Zenith televisions, at which he was immediately successful. He launched his career in finance as the finance manager at Johnny Haas Lincoln Mercury. He then began his brokerage career at First Financial in 1980, which is where he met the beautiful Deanie Turner Jacobson, a trader. They married in 1985, bending their love for gardening, dogs, family, and travel. Mike was the ultimate entrepreneur. While he achieved great success at his aforementioned jobs, he also took risks and dabbled in a variety of ventures, including worm farms, a collection agency, and a power plant. He found the most success, however, managing investments for the private family office he started around the turn of the century. Mike was all or nothing in his approach to endeavors of all kinds. "If you're going to do it the right way and do it all the way," he would say. His unmatched work ethic produced the most stunning flower gardens and gorgeous green lawns, and he enthusiastically shared his gardening skills, dropping off fertilizer and flowers at family and friends' homes throughout Denver every spring. Mike and Deanie's home was also always filled with heavy breathing, slobber, and barking of at least two or three, or sometimes even five, smash-faced dogs. No matter the dog size or snoring volume, their dogs filled into the master bedroom every night, much to Mike's delight. He was an avid fan and loyal season ticket holder for both the Colorado Rockies and Denver Broncos. He literally never missed a home game. Yes, Mike was at 81 Rockies home games last season and made several trips each year to see them on the road as well. Mike was a loyal, generous, passionate, and most of all, kind friend. He will be remembered fondly by an abundant group of friends whom he met in high school, college, the financial world, and on the golf course at the Denver Country Club. Though he left us too soon, he was fortunate to have experiences and see places most will never have the opportunity to do or see. Mike often told his children, "The harder you work, the luckier you get." When reflecting recently on his own luck, Mike shared that his favorite memories were at the 2018 Kentucky Derby and the 2019 Masters. But Mike was by far the happiest in Hawaii with his family every holiday season. He is survived by the love of his life, Deanie, his children, Jennifer, husband, Chris Johnson, Brad, wife, Ashley Underwood, and his five cherished grandchildren, Maddie, Cooper, Lanning, Jovi, and Walker, along with his former spouse and dear friend, Valerie Scott. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made in Mike's honor to the Boys and Girls Club of Metro Denver or the Colorectal Cancer Alliance. A celebration of his life will be hosted on January 28th at 12 p.m. at the Denver Country Club. Bonnie L. Varner of Littleton. Viewing Saturday, January 29th, 10 a.m. with a celebration of life at 11 a.m. at the chapel at Lewis at Ella's family. Life, sketch, and tribute wall at www.ellisfamilyservices.com. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. "That $1,000 bourbon you bought may be a phony," by Clay Risen, the New York Times Company. To the casual eye, there was nothing amiss about the bottle of whiskey sitting on a shelf at Acker, a wine store at New York's Upper West Side. But for anyone who knew what to look for, the warning signs were clear. The whiskey, a bourbon called Colonel E.H. Taylor 4-grain that Acker was selling for about $1,000, normally came packaged in a special cardboard tube. This one sat there tubeless. Its strip stamp attached over the top of the cork was on backward. Still, when a producer from the TV news program Inside Edition asked in April about the bottle's authenticity, the store assured him it was legitimate. The producer bought the whiskey, then took it to Buffalo Trace, the Kentucky distillery that makes the Colonel E.H. Taylor line of bourbon for chemical analysis. The bottle, it turned out, was fake. It had been refilled with cheap whiskey and resealed, then sold to Acker as part of a private collection. The store said it had already pulled several bottles from the collection off the shelf and offered refunds on bottles it had already sold, but that didn't stop. That didn't stop Inside Edition from featuring the incident in an eye-popping news report a few weeks later. It was just the latest high-profile example of what distillers, retailers, and consumers describe as a growing problem for the bourbon industry and its millions of enthusiasts. Over the past few years, counterfeiting, long a problem of purveyors of fine wines and single malt scotch, has come to American whiskey. We've had fans from across the U.S. contact us to tell us they've been duped. Mary Tortorese, general counsel for Sazerac, the company that sells Buffalo Trace, said in a statement in September. The scammers are finding fertile ground. Luxury bourbon was once an oxymoron. Now it's the hottest thing in whiskey. Domestic sales of super premium American whiskey, bottles valued at more than $50, nearly doubled from 2016 to 2020 to 4 million cases, compared with an average growth of 30% for all American whiskeys, according to the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. At the high end, where bottles sell for $500 or more, demand has vastly outstripped supply, creating long lines at liquor stores and a robust secondary market, mostly within private social media groups. Trading or selling in such groups is illegal, although some places, including Kentucky and New York State, are starting to loosen their laws to allow private collectors to sell through an auction or to license retailers like Acker. The disruptions caused by the pandemic have also created a new cohort of swindlers, some driven by economic desperation, others by boredom. And it has spawned a new pool of victims as bourbon drinkers stuck at home with disposable income join the collecting fray, eager to show off their latest trophy. Part of the problem is the culture I see around bourbon, where it is about bragging rights and being able to Instagram a bottle you just bought, said Adam Hertz, a whiskey collector in Los Angeles and an expert in counterfeit bottles. Most people I see ending up with fakes are partly to blame themselves. Any good con man knows how to take advantage of someone's greed. Bourbon in 2021 is, in other words, a counterfeiter's dream, shaped by enormous demand, limited supply, and a steady inflow of new and naive fans all too willing to part with their money and unlikely to go to authorities when they realize they've been swindled in a transaction that is by definition illegal. To make the deception even easier, most distilleries are only slowly taking action. Few are willing to admit the problem publicly for fear of encouraging counterfeiters and discouraging interest in their own legitimate products. Many still package their bottles with common shrink-wrap seals, despite the ease with which such closures can be faked. Even speaking publicly about phony bottles poses a dilemma, because the barriers to counterfeiting and the penalties for getting caught are so low, any discussion of fake whiskey may push more people to try their hand at it, or, if they're already involved, give them tips to improve their game. The American counterfeit trade is still a few years behind the market for counterfeit single malt scotch, where fakery has a much longer and more sophisticated lineage. Isabel Graham Yule, director of Whiskey Auction, an online auction website, said that worldwide, counterfeit scotch has long been a thriving business, often run by organized crime and focused on volume, churning out thousands of outright fakes and knockoffs with deceptively familiar names, James Walker, for example, or Cutty Stark. Most of the high-volume, low-value trade takes place in developing markets where demand for whiskey, luxury goods is strong and regulatory oversight is weak. A different problem confronts the makers of high-end single malt scotch and bourbon. Much of the counterfeiting is done by small groups or individuals, and bottles may pass through several unsuspecting hands before they reach the expert eyes at auction houses. To make matters harder for auctioneers like Graham Yule, private trade in bottles is largely legal in Britain. I saw one collection that was in its entirety fake, and it had all been gathered 20 to 30 years ago, she said. There are some really well-known fakes that keep popping up. The whiskey trade has yet to see its version of Rudy Kernayawan, a prolific high-skilled counterfeiter whose 2013 conviction for making and selling millions of dollars worth of precisely detailed fake Burgundy and California Cabernet rocked the wine world. But it may be only a matter of time. Experts say they have seen an increase in the quality of counterfeits. Hertz suspects that at least a few counterfeiters have inside connections at Kentucky distilleries, allowing them to build fake bottles from scratch with pristine labels and expertly crafted closures. A cottage industry has popped up in response, especially in Britain, promising high-tech countermeasures like through-the-glass chemical analysis, which allows sellers and collectors to assess a bottle's authenticity without having to open it. But those are still in development and years away from widespread use. Easier solutions already exist. The Macallan, among other distilleries, has started to place holographic images on its seals. Ardnoy Merchant, another Scottish distillery, is adding QR codes to its labels, allowing retailers and consumers to check for authenticity with their smartphones. In October, Buffalo Trace placed security tags inside the aluminum caps on some bottles in its highly sought-after antique collection line. Scanning the tags with a special app will tell you if and when the bottle has been opened before. It's a start, but such tags work only when the bottle has been opened, so it's no help for retailers or collectors who want to hold on to it for a while. For now, the best, if imperfect response is for buyers to change their expectations when hunting for a good deal. Simple rules apply. Do your homework, never trust a pushy stranger, especially online, and always be willing to pass on a bottle that looks too good to be true, because it probably is. King Soopers contract. It's really going to set the bar. Union president says that more than 95% who voted were in favor, by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. The agreement approved by Denver area King Soopers employees after a 10-day strike is an industry-leading contract that fixes long-time problems, said Kim Cordova, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7. Union members voted Monday to ratify the contract, officially ending the labor dispute that involved more than 8,000 employees in Boulder, Parker, and the Denver area. Employees at King Soopers and City Market stores in other parts of the state will vote on the contract Wednesday through Monday. The work that our members did by going out on strike and taking a stand against King Soopers' unfair labor practices, it's really going to set the bar and the standard, hopefully, for workers around the country to really strive for that kind of change, Cordova said. Kroger, King Soopers parent company, also has contracts with union members in New Mexico, Southern California, and the Seattle area that are up for renewal. The three-year agreement includes hourly pay raises of $2 to $5.99, more investment in the workers' health care plan, and a faster path for part-time workers to become full-time, Cordova said. The contract addresses a two-tier pay structure that paid lower wages to people hired after 2005, she added. Cordova declined to disclose what percentage of the Denver area union members voted Monday, but she said more than 95% of those who turned out voted in favor of the agreement. King Soopers agreed to add 500 new full-time positions within 90 days of contract ratification, responding to union members' complaints of understaffing. Cordova said the positions will be filled by promoting part-time workers under new provisions aimed at making it easier for people to move to full-time. Last week, Marcy Goldis, a 29-year King Soopers employee, voiced frustration with not getting a chance to read the proposal before the day of the vote. On Tuesday, she said she was satisfied with the contract. Some people aren't happy about it. Some of them think we could have gotten more, Goldis said. Comments on the UFCW Local 7 Facebook page include complaints about the size of the raises and that employees didn't get bonuses for approving the contract. King Soopers offered bonuses of $2,000 to $4,000 for ratifying the agreement, but yanked the offer later in the negotiations. Cordova said the proposed bonuses came with poison pill provisions. She said the $27 million that would have been paid for the bonuses were added to the wages of employees at the top of the pay scale. "I think we got a pretty darn good fair contract," Golda said. "I'm happy with my health care, insurance, and the pay raise." The insurance premiums will stay the same this year and rise by $1 to $3 a week in 2023 to enhance disability benefits. Joe Kelly, president of King Soopers and City Market, said in a statement Monday that the company's goal from the start was to put more money in our associates' paychecks. The UFCW Local 7 began negotiating in October with King Soopers and City Market, both owned by Cincinnati-based Kroger and Albertsons, which owns Safeway and Albertsons stores. The talks between the union and King Soopers, Colorado's largest grocery chain, broke off on January 6th. Union members in Denver area voted to authorize a strike and took to the picket lines January 12th. The last strike by Colorado grocery store workers was against King Soopers in 1996. That dispute lasted 42 days. Safeway and Albertsons stores ended up locking out their employees during the strike. After talks with King Soopers stopped, the union extended negotiation with Albertsons and Safeway. Cordova said the union will schedule bargaining sessions with the company leading up to the strike and on the picket lines. Union members said safety during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and in the face of rising crime were important. The union said it wanted armed security guards to protect employees. "Under the new contract, there will be some guards in stores," Cordova said. King Soopers managers and the union will meet to decide where guards will be located. "All of the areas are different and the needs are different," Cordova said. "The agreement makes clear that employees have a right to defend themselves if attacked," Cordova said. Union members said the company hasn't backed them up when customers have refused to wear masks. Cordova said the company has agreed to enforce mask mandates. Cordova said the support of the community was strong, with many people refusing to cross the picket lines. She said King Soopers, which advertised for replacement workers, struggled to keep stores open and closed some departments because of lack of adequate staff. The UFCW Local 7 and King Soopers settled a lawsuit the union filed at the end of December that accused the company of unfair labor practices, including using third-party staffing agencies to do union-covered work. No more. They have 6 months to get them out of there. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday, January 26th edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.